in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next Tuesday evening, a very special event is going to be occurring at Carthage College. It will be the Reaching for Rainbows Pursuit of Excellence Gala, put on by the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund. And this is a group that I know many of you are very well acquainted with, a group that, among other things, seeks to provide educational opportunities through scholarships for economically and academically deserving youth in the Kenosha area. One of the things that will happen Tuesday evening, besides the presentation of some scholarship awards to some deserving young students, is also the presentation of some awards, and specifically two awards that are called now the Brian Albrecht Living Legend Award. And of course, Brian Albrecht was for many years the president here at Gateway Technical College, and someone who beyond the walls of Gateway was incredibly active in the community and still is. And so this new award bears his name, and two very deserving gentlemen are receiving the Brian Albrecht Living Legend Award. On Monday's morning show, you will meet Anthony Kennedy. And today, we're happy to have the other living legend, if you will, in our studios, Byron Wright. For many, many years, he tells me 35 years, he worked for Kenosha Human Development Services, and for the last 17 years of that 35 as the executive director. Also served for a time as interim director for Women and Children's Horizons, has worked extensively with the Emergency Services Network, and in so many other kinds of ways, working with young people in our community, and in particular, working with young people who have been, in a sense, in the system and are aging out of the system and might be in need of a place, safe place, a stable place to live. He's also worked with the prison population as well, for people getting out of prison. Do they go? Where can they live? Where can they begin to build a stable, safe life for themselves? Hard work, sometimes thankless work, but also gratifying work when one sees the great difference that you're making in the community. And certainly there's no question that Byron Wright has made a difference for the better in the lives of all kinds of people. Hence, being named for this Living Legend Award, which again he will receive at this special gala coming up Tuesday night on the campus of Carthage College. And I'm so happy that for part one of today's morning show today, I can meet for the first time someone I've heard so much about for so many years. Byron Wright, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So glad to have you here. And it's great to put a face and a voice with the name that I've seen for such a long time. I mean, as long as I've been living here in Kenosha, actually. I was a little surprised to learn that you're not a Kenosha native. You were telling me before we went on the air that you actually come from the South. How did you find your way from the South to Kenosha?
Well, I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. When I was 7 years old, my father decided that Tennessee was just too cold for human beings to live, and he moved me and my two sisters and my mother. We moved to the Gulf Coast of Florida to a little town called Crystal River, where he and my mother were in the real estate business, were there for 13 years, and then went back to Tennessee. So I went to Florida State University for my undergraduate degree, and I was an RA in the dorm. And as a part of that, I had a resident show up in the dorm who was ill. He had pneumonia. And so I put him to bed and registered for all his classes. Guy's name was Marty Potter. One of his first professional jobs, he was from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Mm. One of his first professional jobs out of college was as a probation officer in Kenosha.
Hmm.
And so I came up here to visit him in 1977 and kind of drifted back and forth between Florida and Kenosha from 77 to 82. And in 82, Marty had quit being a probation officer, was going back to school, but he was working for Kenosha Human Development Services. And so I filled out an application, and my first job there was what was known as a live-in teaching parent.
Hmm.
So I went to work at Phoenix House, which was a long-term group home, and I say long-term, basically about 6 months for, at the time, for boys, and then it switched to co-ed. So we had eight teens at a time, and we worked the lovely shift of, we worked 96 on and 48 off. So we slept there, ate there with the kids. We were called teaching parents.
Hmm.
And it was an enormously valuable experience for anybody who got to do it. It was very wearying. I did it for 2 years, 1 year at Phoenix House and 1 year at the juvenile shelter care. But it was a great way to learn how to deal with behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And to realize, too, that a lot of kids are going through a lot of things where what you've really got to work with them on is helping to figure out ways to control their behavior, because if you can't control your behavior, you don't get to stay in the community.
Mm.
So that's how I got to Kenosha, was through my friend Marty. That's how I got to Kenosha Human Development Services.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I got there in 19, after I was there for 2 years, I decided I'd had enough living in. I was leaving. My boss at the time, George Schwartz, he looked at me when I said, well, I'm leaving and I'm going back to Florida. And he says, well, he came to me and said, why don't you take a leave of absence? And I'm like, well, why? I don't think I'm coming back here. And he said, well, he says, if you do, when you come back to work for us, you'll have 2 years seniority and you'll get your vacation. Well, I think George knew better than I did that I might end up here again.
Huh.
And so I was back by March of 85. And because I was on my leave, I just kept working there.
Mm.
And the first thing that I did there coming back in 85 was Kenosha County had gotten a grant to set up a group home for older adolescents. And they were going to help them get vocational degrees. Well, whoever wrote it, it wasn't very realistic, one, because it assumed that those kids knew what they wanted to do,
mm.
and two, there wasn't enough money there to start a group home.
Mm.
So George was always a very inventive thinker, and what George said is, he said, well, why don't we put kids at KYF, which is what we did, who are 17 years old, as a living arrangement, and we will start off, we started off, and we said, and we're going to have a meet at Frank's Diner.
Mm.
So that's kind of how independent living started. So we started, when we started doing independent living in 1985, there was no national independent living movement yet. It started about 86 or 87.
So you were leading the way.
We were. Kenosha was on the cutting edge. And there's a guy in Cincinnati named Mark Croner with Lighthouse Youth Services, and both he and I started a little before the federal funding started. So I've been working and thinking about how to deal with that population and how to help that population for a long time.
So if we looked at you as a young person, I mean, like back in junior high and high school and so on, did you already have this kind of passion for helping people, or is that something that developed a little bit later?
Absolutely not. Not in any way, shape, or form did I think that that might be something I would do. I really thought I was going to be a history teacher.
Oh.
And that's what my education is. I have a bachelor's degree in political science, and I was certified to teach history. When I got out of college in 1975, there was a teacher glut. I bought a nice new suit, and I drove to every county in Florida, and 67 of them, and put in an application, and I got nothing. So I really did not know what I was going to do. I was very fortunate. What I knew I needed to do during those years, and I think this was very helpful, is I needed to work because I needed to eat. And so from 75 to 82, drifting back and forth kind of between Wisconsin and Florida, I worked 19 different jobs.
Wow.
So I certainly understood what it was like to be young and uncertain about what you wanted to do and where your life was heading.
And I suppose the other thing is when you bounce from job to job to job, you learn so much, and you probably, among other things, maybe even not aware of it at the time, you learn so much about people, what makes people tick, because you end up working side by side probably with a wide array of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. You know, and the other thing I had no familiarity with until I came to Kenosha was I didn't really realize I knew it, you know, kind of intellectually, but I didn't realize people really worked in factories. Because I grew up in the rural South. There wasn't a factory anywhere around here, around where I was growing up. So that was a completely different culture to me, and I worked in a few factories up here and did one thing and another. But I've always been very interested in people, and so wherever I worked, I was always kind of trying to find out what people's story was.
Mm. Tell us about the experience of working with Kenosha Human Development Services and in a sense, the you're part of that experience being actually working with people, I mean, with your clients, so to speak, I mean, with the population you were serving versus, you know, kind of the paperwork and the regulations and that part of it that kind of sets the framework, but probably is also kind of a complication and a challenge in and of itself.
Well, it's certainly over the years since I started working there, there's a lot more of it. There's a lot more paperwork. What was the nice thing about Kenosha Human Development Services is we had enormously supportive management. And, you know, it's kind of funny when you look back. When I went to work there in 82, I thought the agency had been around forever, and my boss, George, was older in the hills, and he was 47, and the agency had been around for about 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
And so George was the director, and the director of the residential services and the clinical side was a guy named Dick Kaufman. And what they were enormously supportive people to work for. And the other thing is one of the things about Kenosha Human Development Services, and this really came mainly from Dick Kaufman, is we had a model of care. We had a philosophy. KHDS still has a philosophy that developed out of that early years with Dick. And that has been key, I think, to the agency being able to help people. And so it's the first place I ever worked I really liked. And I really liked the people that I was working for. You know, when I went to work there, there were about 30 people in the agency, and most of us were out in residential facilities.
So right in the trenches.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where I started out. And like I say, did that for 2 years living in, well, it was 96 on, 48 off, but every fourth, it was 4-3, 4-3, 4-2, 4-2, 3-3. Then you got an extra day off. So
tell us about the gauntlet of doing this kind of work in which, I mean, you obviously experience some really gratifying successes, but of course there are also all kinds of situations in which, for one reason or another, you know, a young person just can't be saved or falls prey to other influences or whatever it might be. Just talk about that balance between the successes and the disappointments that are inherent with this kind of work.
I think what I learned very early on is that to take the long view. Mm. Well, because part of it is what I knew from my own personal experiences is I had no idea what I wanted to do at 18. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was 26. Mm. So what I knew is that these kids, a lot of times that we were working with, they were dealing with a lot of trauma. And it was unrealistic to expect them to, like, succeed immediately. Mm. And so I really felt like I had the long view of it. The other thing that I learned very early on, and this was greatly because of Dick Kaufman, and what we learned was, is not to take it personally.
Mm.
You know, no matter, because you got a lot of negative behavior thrown at you because you were there, which in no way was, it wasn't because a lot of times what you were doing, it's because of the trauma they had experienced. And a lot of times they just didn't have a lot of skills. And so a lot of times we were trying to teach them real basic skills, like how to follow instructions, how to disagree appropriately, mm. how to accept a compliment, how to accept criticism. So we were always teaching skills. That was a big part of the model. So in some ways it was very, you know, you were worn out when you finished a shift, but I really looked at it as the people we're working with, they're in the midst of a process.
Mm.
And it's very unrealistic to say, well, they're ready to settle down and start a job. And a lot of them know.
Yeah.
No more than I was.
Well, and it sounds like what you were very well aware of is that you were just one part of that arc of their life. And
yes.
And you didn't need to be, in a sense, the culmination, the final success. You might be just one stepping stone.
Well, and a lot of times it's very funny because I have lived in one of two houses that are side by side in Columbus Park since 88. And back when the phone book still existed, I was always in the book.
Mm.
You know, my number was, my address. And so I've had the luxury of knowing a lot of the youth that I started working with. It's kind of an odd thing to say. The ones I started with are 55 now.
Wow.
So some of the folks that I've worked with when they were teens, I still am in touch with.
Wow.
So, like I say, I've always had kind of the long view of things. And it's interesting. One of the things that kids will say, and I'll see them someplace, and they'll say things like, well, boy, you said something that was really important to me. And I'm like, what? Only one thing? But what you learn a lot of times is that their lives are in such chaos when you're dealing with them that they're not in a position where they're ready to learn a lot of things.
Hmm.
And so a lot of times over the years, I've asked people that we worked with when they were adults, I said, well, what do you remember about us? And a lot of times what they say is, you were nice and you listened to us.
Hmm.
So that's not that hard to do.
Right. And for a young person who is experiencing that not at all in their own lives otherwise, I mean, that can be like the greatest gift you could give them, is to just to see them and hear them and respect them.
And the other thing I learned fairly early on is not to talk too much.
Hmm.
Well, because a lot of times what I was always trying to figure out working with kids is when are they listening? Because if they're emotionally upset, they're not listening.
Right.
So, you know, you try to pick your moments when you think you can get some information in there. But a lot of times I feel like what tends to happen, particularly with kids who've grown up where people are very negative toward them, they just don't listen. They just blah, blah, blah. That's what all this conversation is. And so I just kind of learned over the years, you know, don't talk so much. Mm. Listen more.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Byron Wright, who is about to receive from the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund one of their Brian Albrecht Living Legend Awards for the great work he has done with young people in the Kenosha area for many, many years, working for Kenosha Human Development Services for quite a few years as their executive director. Also has worked extensively with Women's and Children's Horizons, among other agencies in the area. Over the course of the many years that you did this, what would you say the most... Did the kind of fundamental issues and challenges remain the same, or over the course of those 35 years, did you really start to see really different challenges or different issues emerging that would be, you know, in a sense, forcing you to kind of evolve in the way that you did things?
I think if I was working today, probably the thing that would throw me the most is the importance of social media. In people's lives. I tend to be more along the line that I don't think human behavior has changed much over 5,000 years. I mean, I really don't. I think human beings are kind of, you know, what motivates them. And I don't think behavior changes that much. I think technology changes a lot.
Right.
I think culture always changes. And so those are things that change all the time. But to me, in general, kind of how humans operate is pretty consistent. When I was in college, I had a professor whose specialty was American history before the Revolutionary War. So I took 25 hours in that because I liked the guy who was teaching it, and it was fascinating. But what you learn is what motivates people is, you know, kind of the same over history. So
let me ask you about another distinction, the fact that so much of your work involved working with, in a sense, adolescents and older adolescents, and then especially in that moment as they're kind of aging out of, for instance, the foster care system or whatever it might be, and helping them find appropriate housing and really helping kind of usher them into the rest of their lives. On the other hand, you've also done some work with people leaving prison, needing to find that kind of stable, safe environment in which to kind of start over or build a new chapter. And I'm assuming that in terms of working with that population, that that was somewhat older adults versus adolescents.
Mainly young.
Oh, actually, okay.
You know, there's some older fellows, but mainly younger adults. In fact, a lot of more people I already knew, you know, who grew up in. Here's the whole thing: is a lot of times people who were abused and neglected as children end up in the criminal justice system,
right?
And so, a lot of times the issues are the same. The other thing we always did at Columbus House, the 14-bed halfway house, because Kenosha Human Development Services pretty much gatekeep the mental health system for Kenosha County, what I encouraged corrections to do was if they had people coming out of prison with mental health issues, send them to us because we can hook them up with services. Probably the biggest difference between working with adults and children in some ways is when you work with adults in a group home like that or residential facility, if they're doing something they're not supposed to be doing, they want to get away with it. And children will just do it in your face to get your attention.
Ah, that's an interesting distinction.
So that was a big difference, kind of, is kids were never very good at, you know, at hiding what they were doing. Adults, a lot of times, a lot better.
Right.
And I think a lot of times, you know, the other thing about working with adults versus children, if you've been institutionalized and been in prison, you know how to follow rules.
There's a lot of them, aren't there?
Yeah. And so at Columbus House, if we said we had house jobs and one of the jobs was to sweep and mop the kitchen floor and dining room floor twice a day, it pretty much happened. Compared to working with children.
Right. Some of them coming out of situations and environments where there weren't any rules whatsoever. And the whole notion of having to do something was probably pretty foreign.
And also just teaching the skills.
Well, right, sure.
You know, how do you want, you need to teach people how you want things done.
Right, and what is a vacuum cleaner and how you turn it on.
You know, another thing we really emphasized is that children need a sense of belonging. Hmm. And so we wanted to get them involved in kind of the sense, you know, helping kind of set the rules in the house and in decision making. And so they get some sense of fairness. Hmm. And it is as important for kids to contribute as anything else.
Hmm.
Being able to contribute and be a part of something is, I think, a huge thing. I always remember, and I had a kid in shelter once who I was disgusted with the kitchen floor. And so he and I got down on our hands and knees one Saturday morning and scrubbed that floor for about 2.5 hours. And at the end of that, he was about 13 or 14, he looked at me and he says, "This has been the best morning of my life."
Hmm.
And it was because that contributing and being a part of something and spending time with someone and having someone's undivided attention. And I felt kind of the same way that he did.
Wow.
It was a wonderful morning.
Yeah.
So
I want to ask you, as someone whose first life plan was to become a teacher, and of course you ended up in a sense very much being a teacher, but not in the same circumstances you had originally envisioned. I wonder if, at the risk of making some generalizations here, I wonder about the relationship between, you know, some of these challenged, troubled youth and the whole business of education and school and so on, and what kind of difference that makes when a young person, for whatever reason, has a really terrible relationship with the whole matter of school, of being a student, of learning, and that kind of thing. And how much was that a part of what the work that you did in terms of trying to open them up to the possibilities, the new possibilities that are there when you're open to the whole notion of just learning things?
Well, I think part of it is, and this will always be an issue, and I think the schools do a lot of stuff to try to make this happen, but what I used to say is school is the work of a child. And if you go to school every day, just thinking about us, if we go to work every day, and it is a miserable experience, what a horrible way to live.
Mm.
And so that's the way I always looked at it, is we need to try to figure out ways to help kids be successful in school. A lot of that is figuring out how to kind of, how they can manage their behavior on their own. Because certainly what kids learn fairly early on in the school system is if you say a few of the wrong words, you can be done with school every day early.
An exit strategy.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, and I would watch kids get caught up in power struggles with the school and get suspended every day.
Hmm.
So sometimes I just looked at it and, you know, everybody was always saying, well, you got to get them through high school. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to get them through high school right now. They got one credit and they're 18 years old. So let's come up with an alternate plan, maybe adult education, GEDs. I think it's hard for a lot of the kids that we worked with to be successful in school. One is, and they're not reinforced for it by a lot of times their families.
Right.
Education isn't valued. So school's a real key part of it, but at the time we were getting them a lot of times it wasn't in the forefront. You know, education's something that, what I learned is sometimes it took a couple of years where they'd be ready to go back to school.
Right. You were telling me before we went on the air that one of your great passions is as a reader. And
yes,
not only are you a passionate reader, but you are also a passionate sharer of books. I mean, that this is something that really means a lot to you. And I don't know if this is just with friends and acquaintances and coworkers, or if it's also with, for instance, the adolescents with which you've worked so much, if that's also part of where you would kind of do that kind of thing. But tell us more about the role of reading in your life and how the sharing of books has been really important to you.
This is much more something with people that are friends and the generation. I don't have children, but I have godchildren and nieces and nephews. Mm. And so I grew up 7 miles out of a town of 1,200. I went to the library every Wednesday and Saturday. When I learned how to read in first grade in Nashville, I didn't go to kindergarten. It was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. I read 136 books in first grade.
Wow.
It was something I just was fascinated from the beginning. And so I have read all my life. And when I find books I like, or I think other people will like, or they will say something to them, pass them on. For example, in Wisconsin, and of course a lot of people in Wisconsin, if people live in Wisconsin and they haven't read a Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, I'm like, well, that's something maybe you want to read.
Absolutely.
You know, about the... And I like a lot of natural history sort of stuff. There are authors I really like. I like Barry Lopez. He wrote a book called Arctic Dreams that I think is a wonderful book. There's a book I've given away 20 copies of called A Natural History of Parenting by Susan Allport, which is a history of parenting among all species, including humans, that I think is just a wonderful book. A challenging book, but one that I read many years ago was called Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, who said that fear of death and repression of that fear is the shaping force of all human personality.
Wow.
And that's a deep and dark book. But
yeah.
At one point, I bought 25 copies of it, and I think I have one left. So I say, well, you should read this book.
Yeah.
Another area I've read a lot about, particularly in the last few years, particularly after what happened in Kenosha with Jacob Blake and all of that, was just thinking some about, you know, the history of race and in this country again. And so I read a bunch of books right when all that was going on, from South of Freedom by Carl Rowan, that was written in 1952 when he went back home to Tennessee. He was working in Minneapolis at the time. Whiteness of Wealth by Dorothy Brown, that says that the tax code is kind of biased against African-American people. I think Kendi, stamped from the beginning, History of Racist Ideas in the United States, I think is a very important book. And Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, about housing discrimination after World War II. You know, I think it's important that we understand our history. And just to me, a lot of what you can learn about the world, at least from my perspective, is books are a good way to learn things. You know, it's a much more in-depth view of, and you can kind of stop and think and take notes. And so I'm always sending people books. I've become, I really like, I'm not always crazy about Amazon, but it is awfully nice to just say, oh, I'm going to send that book to somebody today.
Yeah, right. It does make it easy.
Yes.
So in your retirement from Kenosha Human Development Services, I imagine that affords you a little more time to read, but I know that even though officially you're retired, you're continuing to be active in one way or another, and I know that you continue to be to care deeply about all these issues and the good work being done by Kenosha Human Development Services. So probably for you, retirement is with an asterisk, I'm guessing.
Somewhat. You know, when I left Kenosha Human Development Services, I really got away from it because I think it's hard. It would be hard to have any official role after being there for so long.
And you want the next leader to be able to step forward, of course.
And, you know, the current director, Janine Field, I've known for, my guess is certainly over 30 years. And there are still people working there doing good work in the community. Pam Tenuta, who is still working at Independent Living. Pam Tenuta and I started working at Kids in 1982. Hmm. And Pam has been enormously valuable as a support system for all sorts of kids. And that she's still doing that work after all these years, you know, to me is rather remarkable. Denise Durdine, who ended up, we were a year apart working in the group home. When I left, she came in. Her roommate working in the group home originally is Nancy, who I married. So we are still all friends after all these years, and Denise is still doing the good work with victims of crime. And so there's a lot of people who work for Kenosha Human Development Services who've been there a long time and are still doing good work. And so I chose when I retired to basically stay involved with the Emergency Services Network because I really think that low income and homelessness are huge barriers to overcome. There's nothing good about being poor in America. It just isn't.
Right.
And, you know, when you look at it, like if you're on Social Security disability, you're getting about $1,000 a month now. Right now, I was just looking this morning, just out of curiosity, well, what's the rent for a one-bedroom apartment? About $900 a month. Mm-hmm. So I think that poverty is a big issue, and I think it really is pretty difficult for a lot of folks to overcome.
Right. And, of course, you and others who care about this issue have done so much to try to make a difference, you know, person by person in their lives, confronting those kind of challenges. And it's not any surprise whatsoever that that the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund want to honor you with this Living Legend Award, you and Anthony Kennedy, for all of this good work, in the hope that it will be an inspiration to others to take up that gauntlet in the same way. We want to remind people that the Reaching for Rainbows Pursuit of Excellence Gala is going to be happening at Carthage College next Tuesday evening. And if you want more information about the event, you can go to www.mahonefund.org to learn more about that great organization and about this big event coming up on Tuesday in case you want to attend. And Byron Wright, it's been so great to meet you and to hear about your eventful life and the great work that you've done. Thank you so much for being a part of the morning show today, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you, and I look forward to the Mahone Reaching for Rainbows and their efforts to provide scholarships to kids going on to school.
It's great work, and it needs to be supported. So we thank you again for being here for the morning show. It's 8:48, and part two of the morning show is coming up right now.
Okay.
To finish out today's morning show, I'm going to be replaying a conversation I recorded back in the summer of 2021 with John Meacham, talking about what was at the time his most recent book, His Truth is Marching On, John Lewis and the Power of Hope. This interview was actually recorded in the midst of the unrest and rioting that occurred in the wake of the killing of Jacob Blake. Hope is one of the words in the subtitle of this book about John Lewis. And of course, it is a reminder of something President Obama said during the Democratic National Convention, which is, if anybody had reason to give up hope and to become cynical and hopeless, it would be those who were engaged in some of the most difficult moments of the civil rights movement. Tell us what you saw in John Lewis that allowed him to have sustained hope through so many incredibly difficult years.
He believed in a way that so few of us can, that the world could be brought closer into tune with America's professed ideals and also with the implications of the biblical and moral teachings of a beloved community, based on the notion that we should, in fact, attempt to love our neighbor as ourselves. And from his earliest hours in Pike County, Alabama, he was the great-grandson of an enslaved person. He was the son of sharecroppers. He was a figure who came of age in a segregated universe. He had an intuitive moral revulsion to the segregated apartheid-like order of my native region. And because of his church, because of the gospel that he heard, the prayers that he prayed, he saw that faith in a greater order should not simply be about a better life beyond time, but the tributary of his revulsion at segregation and the belief, perennial, persistent belief that the gospel spoke to us not simply beyond time, but in time, led him to see that he was called, and I use that word advisedly, he was called, summoned by history to put the biblical injunctions into action. Words became deeds. And he believed he was living out his life according to a divine purpose. And that may grate on modern ears. It grated on modern ears then, right? There was a great division in the civil rights movement between the Sunday school folks like King and Lewis and the more secular folks who became even more insistent on systemic change. So this was not smooth sailing either internally within the movement or externally as the movement took its case to the people, took the cases to the people, because there was more than one. But as Bernard Lafayette, his college roommate in Nashville, said, John was never going to give up. And it was something of a miracle that John Lewis survived those years because he always led with his head and he never raised a fist.
At one point in your book, you say that John Lewis was as important to the founding of a modern and multi-ethnic 20th and 21st century America as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Samuel Adams were to the initial creation of the Republic itself in the 18th century. What leads you to say that?
Because the country we're living in, the country that faced the election in 16, the country that faces the election in 70 days or so, is a pluralistic, multi-ethnic nation of changing demography. And for all of its limitations, it has the widest possible participation by the largest number of people. And that was not true before 1965. 100 years after Appomattox, there was functional apartheid in this country. We continue to live under an immigration system that had been established in the 1920s, that established national quotas, was very much biased toward European nations. And in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act, in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, and with President Johnson's Immigration and Nationality Act, which is a piece of Great Society legislation that doesn't get enough attention, it fundamentally changed the infrastructure of identity in this country. In many ways, I would argue that the country you and I know, the country you and I live in, is really only 55 years old, because before 1965, it was still a country that enforced in law white supremacy. And what John Lewis insisted on, what Ella Baker insisted on, what Diane Nash insisted upon, what Dr. King insisted upon, what Stokely Carmichael insisted upon, was no, that America was not supposed to be a project of exclusion, but a project in universal liberty. And however imperfectly we've realized the implications of that argument, this electorate in 2020 is radically different, and I would argue better, than it was 55 years ago. And John Lewis was the Paul Revere of that, right? He was a foot soldier and a field commander in really a second or even third American Revolution. If you consider the first revolution to be in the late 18th century, the second to be the Civil War, really the third was the work of the 1950s and 1960s to open the doors. What we are seeing, not least in your backyard, is how incompletely we have realized what we have to do. But we are in a better place, however imperfect this place is, because of the courage of people like John Lewis.
A last question. Explain to our listeners how well you knew John Lewis and the circumstances under which you were able to speak with him over the years.
30 years ago, 28 years ago, I was a baby reporter for the Chattanooga Times, my hometown newspaper. I was covering Georgia politics. We were right across the state line, and I met him on an election night in 1992. One of the things about election nights is if you're a politician, the measure of your power is how little you are seen, because people expect you to be in sort of like a priest-like way off, you know, doing important things. John and Lillian, his wife, were in the ballroom with everybody all night, just sitting and standing there. And I walked up and was tremulous, I will confess, because his historic role was already clear, and started up a conversation. And I was incredibly blessed, as were thousands of other people, to spend time with him through the decades. We spent time in Nashville and Sewanee, Tennessee, and Atlanta and Washington and New York. We talked a lot through the years, usually after a big news event, after Katrina, say, when he was talking about the role, what we had to do about poverty, or for one of the many commemorations. John always believed in the power of story. He believed in these anniversaries not to celebrate what had happened, but to reaffirm what has to happen. And I was, when he was diagnosed with the pancreatic cancer that ultimately killed him, I wanted to have a kind of final round of conversations for a project like this. And then when I was honored to be with my family and a lot of other folks on the Pettus Bridge with him in March, it just occurred to me that this was the time, that his exemplary life has so much to teach us, that it's a story that we can't tell enough. Hmm.
The book again is titled His Truth is Marching On, John Lewis and the Power of Hope, published by Random House, the author John Meacham. John Meacham, thank you for giving the world this important book, and thank you for being part of the morning show once again.
Thank you. Take good care out there.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be previewing an exciting concert coming up at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Two concerts, actually. Combining the choirs with the jazz ensemble to perform a jazz-styled mass by Wynton Marsalis. Also, a look at the greatest family of jockeys, the Turcotts, on the eve of yet another Kentucky Derby. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today's going to be a mostly sunny day with a high of 69 degrees. It will be a little bit cooler near the lake. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 48. Tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny, and we're actually headed for a high of 71 degrees, a little bit warmer than had been initially forecast. Saturday, mostly sunny, 66. Sunday, sunny, 69. We have a decent chance of some rain entering our forecast early next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News.